Dr. Show!
You have all made it through the dance. You have all made it
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 78. I'm your host, John X. Thank you for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. Man, oh man, I love this week's guest. I love him sincerely. It's a guy I've had the pleasure of working with pretty directly, and I challenge you to find someone who is more sincere, more honest, more hardworking, and just a better dude than Bill Jerky. Now, Bill Jerky has had an incredible career. He grew up in Weld County and still lives on his family farm, where he talks about it. He built a new house there. But Bill grew up in agriculture. He went to college at UNC. He ran a Christmas tree farm. He's worked in politics. He was a state legislator for 8 years and also a Weld County commissioner for 8 years. And he is currently the executive director of FUEL, which stands for Fostering Unity, Energizing Leadership. And Bill is someone I came across when I was working in corporate, and just the depth of knowledge that he has is remarkable. And it's a real privilege to get to talk to someone with the wealth of experience that he has. So we cover so much in this episode. It reminds me of last week talking to Tom Herron about issues related to agriculture, like GMOs and urban sprawl and things like that. Bill knows more about water than most of the people I've ever met. And his understanding of how water interplays with Weld County and with agriculture and with oil and gas and, you know, the doctrine of prior appropriation, we talk about that. I know I'm doing a weird job of selling this episode when I talk about water law, but it ties into what makes Colorado a good place to do business and a good place to grow food. So just so much here. The other thing about Bill is about as fundamental a conservative as you will find. Now, I don't particularly subscribe to the entire ideology of either party. Neither one lines up perfectly with my beliefs and my order of priorities. So I asked Bill, I'm like, why Republicanism? Like, what is it about the Republican Party that draws you to it? And he gives a pretty good answer. I mean, Bill is very sincere in his beliefs. And listening to him describe the principles of conservatism as he sees them make a really good case for Bill's belief system. Now, I'd ask the same thing of Democrats. What is it at the core of your beliefs? Why do you believe in your bones that, you know, this is the way we should govern our country? The way we should govern our state, the way we should govern our county, whatever it is. What is it? Like, what are those core tenets? And Bill lays them out for me pretty clearly. So whether or not you agree with him, if you happen to be, you know, if you lean left, if you're a Democrat, if you're progressive, listen to this episode. You might learn a little bit more about conservatism. If you're a conservative, a lot of this will probably ring true to you. So just a lot of fun talking to Bill Jerky and about how these principles influenced the way that he governed, too, when he was in the state house and then when he was a Weld County commissioner. So a lot going on in this episode. Think you'll really enjoy it. First, to pay a couple of bills. For the episode featuring Bill, our sponsor is 4Degrees, the number 4DEGRE.ES. You know, speaking of campaigns, we are coming up on the first Tuesday in November, which is always election day. 4Degrees has been hard at work for their clients, doing advertising, doing grassroots outreach, doing all sorts of social media marketing. That's kind of their bread and butter. They're really good at that. So they've been out in full force doing this, and they do excellent, excellent work. So if you have a campaign, if you have a product, if you have an audience you need to build, get your message out using 4Degrees. They have a long proven track record of clients. Go to their website, the number 4DEGRE.ES, and you will see the successes that they've had. So I am so happy that they chose to sponsor the John of All Trades podcast and provide web hosting for me. They also provide tech support. So one more time, the number 4DEGRE.ES. Let's get to this week's episode. It's episode 78. Bill Jerky is in the house, and we have a long chat about all sorts of things: government, campaigning, agriculture issues, what it's like to run a Christmas tree farm. Holy Lord. Christmas trees got to come from somewhere, right? And for a long time, they came from Bill Jerky's farm. Whether it's using a machete to trim them or what it took to pull up the stumps and how the ground was fallow for a year, this is something that you see, you go, I have a Christmas tree in my house. Where does it come from? Don't know, don't care. Well, you should, and it comes from Bill Jerky's farm. Not anymore. They shut it down in, I think, 2012, but great stories here nevertheless. So, episode 78, Bill Jerky. He's kind of I call myself John of all trades. He's kind of a jack of all trades himself. So we sit down and talk to him, and that episode starts right now.
Where would the agenda be? They tried to send me the agenda, and it came out on an attachment. Unfortunately, the attachment went to every other person in that email,
except
not
you.
To me. I am attachment challenged.
What's on tap for this week?
Well, this week will be interesting. Saturday will probably be my most interesting day. I have duck hunting that morning with Ben Popple from Liberty Oil.
Nice.
That'll be fun. And then midday, I get an opportunity to help my son and daughter-in-law. And we raised him the right way, but I'm not so sure about her.
Okay.
She went to CSU, you know.
Those Rams you can't do anything about. You went to UNC, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So sitting here in what were you going to help him do?
I'm going to help him move that day. And then I come back later in the day, and I do the Republican Party's chili event, in which the people there will get to try Buffalo Billy chili.
Ooh.
Elk version.
Okay.
Elk meat in the Buffalo Billy chili this time.
What's your stance on beans in the chili?
I have some beans. These would be pinto. I seek negro black beans.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I was unable to find any black beans this time.
Well, you know what? You are. I'm glad to hear you're not some Texas weirdo who's anti-bean in the chili. I think those people are psychotic.
That would be wrong. And what's more, the bean is a very effective, it spreads your money a little further.
Yeah, it's a nice, it absorbs flavor, it tastes good, and it makes the chili go farther.
And you know, a bean is actually just about the best food you could ever find. It has both proteins and carbohydrates. Beans really do a lot of good. It's one reason why Dave Ramsey stresses rice and beans and rice, for your financial diet as well.
Well, welcome to the Bean Cast here with Bill and John. Sitting here with Bill Jerky here in Zoe's, and this is a lovely coffee shop. You were telling me a little bit about it here in downtown Greeley.
And yeah, it's a former Edward Chevrolet car dealership.
Wow.
Back in my youth, back in the 70s.
It's big enough to be a car dealership. I rarely am I in a coffee shop that has vaulted ceilings like this and this much floor space. It's delightful.
Yeah. Of course, a church bought it, Christ Community Church, one of Greeley's two mega churches. They bought it about 6-7 years ago and bought it to expand to the downtown market so they'd be able to relate to younger people and maybe more downtownish people a little bit better.
Yeah, well, they've done a nice job. I worked here earlier today, and it's one of the finer coffee shops. It's got a nice vibe in here. It's a great place to get some work done.
Yeah, so. Yeah, definitely a nice place.
So it's funny, Bill, because you and I have worked together for a few years now.
4, maybe 5.
Yeah, when I was working corporate, and you had recently ended your term as county commissioner in Weld County, right?
Yeah, I finished up as a commissioner in 08. I had been a little bit of a fan of the show 8 is Enough.
Okay.
So I served my 8 years and got done in 08 and thought there are probably other ways to make a living for next county commissioner rather than being a county commissioner for 4 more years.
Right, rather than getting yelled at by the citizens of Weld County for one reason or another.
Definitely.
And before that, you were, okay, so take me in reverse a little bit. Before you were county commissioner, what was before that?
Well, immediately before that, for 4 years, I worked mostly real estate along with my farming interests. And so I built a few homes during that time, and what I discovered was that people who built homes one at a time and hired the vast majority of it done, which I did, made absolutely no money at all. So 3 of the homes that I developed were on lots that I owned.
Okay.
So I was able to sell those lots, and that's how I made a little bit of money. But I went through the heartbreak of building homes and learning quite a bit about it.
Yeah.
And but financially didn't pay off real well. And so during that time, one of the homes that I built for a couple, well, they really put me through the ringer, John, I got to tell you. They were so rough on me, and within 6 months after finishing that home, they filed for divorce.
Oh, jeez.
And they took it all out on me for the year previous to that.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, when you're making that many decisions in a row, I think you'll find out quickly if you're compatible or not.
Yeah, there's a lot of decisions to be made on building a home, constant communication, and was really, really challenging. I enjoyed it, and the final home that I built was our own home that we have out on the farm. So I'd gotten a chance to make a few mistakes and covered for them on our house and made it a much nicer, better home, and we really love it still. So, of course, the other thing I was doing during that four-year time period, this would be 97 through the year 2000, was running our family farm, yeah. Christmas Tree Acres, which at the time, previous to that and after that, was the largest Christmas tree acre farm in all of Colorado. And so we literally sold thousands of Christmas trees to families that would come out and buy them one at a time.
Wow.
So we would have a very, very busy time period from Thanksgiving weekend through December 24th.
So Black Friday indeed.
Black Friday was wonderful. It opened us up, and so we were able to start turning money that day, and that was our Black Friday was excellent for us every year.
At what point do you start growing Christmas trees? Does it take all year, or how does that work?
It takes multiple years. You buy a seedling that'll be anywhere from 6 inches to maybe 16 inches long or tall.
Okay.
And so you plant that in the spring of the year, and you water it, and you hope that it doesn't die. You try to keep the weeds and the bugs off, and at the end of that year, it might be 4 inches taller. But that set it up so that the second year in the ground,
okay.
It'll grow a foot or more from that point on each year.
Okay.
And each year, starting with the third year, they have to be trimmed one at a time by people, usually teenagers.
Yeah.
And so we would have crews of dozens of teenagers out swinging machetes. I kid you not, these are machetes that have a blade length of like 16 inches or so.
Wow.
And
no
they
joke.
Were sharp. No joke at all, swinging those machetes, all you had to be able to do was be able to go ahead and coordinate between your left ear and your right ankle so that if you didn't cut either your left ear or your right ankle, you'd form the shape that you wanted, the downward shape that you wanted to have for the Christmas tree shape.
So it like a repeatable motion.
A very repeatable motion, and that's why people older than teenagers shouldn't do it because they would get worn out very, very quickly.
Wow.
Our best trimmers were people that were either very, very fit, or like one year, one of our final years, we had a young man out that was 6'9".
Yeah.
And he didn't need any ladder or nothing. He just reached right up to work on the tops.
Had to be a joy to watch him work.
Yeah, it was really fun. And it was a great, enjoyable part of our lives. We raised our family around that. A lot of work ethic went into that.
Sure.
And it was a great tradition for literally thousands of Colorado families to come out and get Christmas trees from us.
It's funny to hear you describe it because, I mean, it's a very agricultural thing that you're doing. You're growing trees. But there's also like a tourist element to that.
Yeah, it was kind of an early agritainment.
Okay,
now, agritainment has come on much, much larger than that since then, and they involve all kinds of rides. And, for example, Fritzler's Scream Acres at Peckham, which is at 85, and Peckham in middle of Well County. They had 1,000 people out there this last Saturday night.
Jeez.
Doing rides and doing fun things and shooting pumpkins at a target, at a scarecrow.
Do they have like a corn maze
away.
Too?
They've got a giant corn maze. This year's is in the shape of a tiger. And the tiger, this is in salute of the conservation effort that's going on in Southeast Weld.
Right.
Where they've got all the wildlife in there. They've got 20, 30, 40 tigers and lions and bears, oh my. It's just an amazing place.
Wow.
So that's the way agritainment has gone. We were on kind of the cutting edge of it, and we did like a little hay bale maze one time.
Okay.
And then other than that, and the fact that people could wander around in 40, maybe 60 acres or more of Christmas trees that were eligible, that was kind of the as far as we went on people being able to entertain themselves out there.
Well, sure. When someone chooses a Christmas tree, they'll pick one. They don't pick them like first family takes the first one, second family takes the second one. They shop, right? I mean,
they shop all over, and this is one of the family dynamics that we found so much fun to watch was the fact that these people would go out as a family, and little Jimmy might want that one over there,
right?
Little Susie, the one 100 yards over, and Dad would look at both and veto them, but Mom would come in and have a whole different choice.
Uh-huh.
And so there were a lot of negotiations. And we always try to get families to cut the tree together, like maybe it was a saw. We always had no axes allowed,
okay.
No chainsaws allowed, because we didn't want their slip to become for our farm to become their farm as a result of liability.
Yeah.
And we never got sued in all those years, never even a threat of a suit. We think we did real well for having that volume of people in. But the negotiation between families, really intense, really interesting. They would mark their trees. They'd find some weed maybe to go ahead and throw up into a tree to mark it, that weed signified that would be that family's tree.
Huh.
And sometimes a week later, that weed is still there because they went on and chose another tree.
Oh, that's too funny. How long did you say you had that?
We operated it. We've planted our first tree in 1980. Wow. We harvested the final trees for landscaping in the spring of 2012.
Okay.
So it was about a 33-year period, more or less. We like to say we did it a third of a century.
Yeah. Why? And what facilitated ending it? Why end it?
Well, we got into it, John, mostly because we wanted to be able to market something directly to the public, kind of cut out the middleman and his profit, so to speak,
right,
and try to go ahead and have a little bit more profit for ourselves that way and not be so subject to nationwide or worldwide commodity prices. And so that only worked to a degree. We started off selling trees for $19 a piece in 1985.
Yeah.
And then the final trees we were selling, the standard choose and cut tree was a $45 tree when we were done, which is still an attractive price.
Yeah, no, that seems like a hell of a deal, actually.
But we got out of it because we aged, and we did not see it making sense for us to continue.
Right.
And then the other big reason was commodity prices recovered dramatically. And part of that was the fact that markets began to open up across the seas. We began to export more and more capitalism to places like India and China, mm-hmm. and more people could afford better diets.
Oh.
And as a result, that, and of course, I'll mention the big E word, ethanol, of course,
right.
also was a user of corn products and other products. As a result of those things, we simply saw better commodity prices for quite a few years.
Gotcha.
We wanted to grow products that we could sell in that year of growing and not be committed to it for maybe a decade.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you said it was what, like a 3-year turnaround for trees?
7, 8, 9 years.
Okay. Oh God.
Yeah, yeah. A very, very long term project.
Okay.
It only grew a foot a year, and
oh,
so you
right,
want to get
yeah.
an 8-foot tree out of it, or 7, 8, 9, whatever it might be.
Okay.
So they took years and years to grow.
Yeah. So the decision to end, was that something that was a long time coming? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right after the turn of the millennia, in a sense, you know,
we didn't
plant new trees after that.
Oh, and you're still in this business for over a decade?
Yes, we were still in the business for more than a decade.
Jeez.
Knowing it would take years to cycle out of it. When we would be done with trees for a particular time period, all that was left out there, it's kind of like the dance you go to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe all the pretty girls are out there dancing. The only ones that are left, maybe nobody wanted to dance with.
Right.
Of course,
yeah.
This isn't politically correct, but let's face it, the prettiest trees got picked.
Sure.
And only the ugly trees were left at the end.
Yeah, the sad, lonely
trees that weren't very attractive.
Yeah.
And so those trees generally, except if they got used for landscaping, and they still might be alive then. But those trees, unfortunately, the ones that weren't really eligible in anyone's eyes, were cut and were piled up and burned. And we had all of the stumps in, and this is normal farmland.
Mm-hmm.
So we bought our own backhoe, and we would go in and pop those stumps one at a time.
Wow.
And that field that we would go into would be fallow for an entire year.
Jeez.
Because it would take weeks and weeks and then finally months and months to pop stumps, drag stumps into a pile, burn stumps, and then finally go back in with a land plane, fill holes, and return that to tillable land again.
That sounds incredibly labor-intensive.
Very, very labor-intensive. We'd have, of course, I had teenage boys a lot of that time, and
yeah.
boys in their early 20s, two of them, but you know, we'd still have to hire a fair amount of outside help just to help us with some of those jobs. Very, very labor intensive, an awful lot of work to that.
Yeah.
And so now I irrigate my corn, and I found out from the guy that harvests my corn, it was a week ago Monday night, I found out when he called to tell me how well it had done, he said, "I don't know how to tell you this, but your corn out of the thousands of acres that we harvested this year was the best in the whole valley."
Great.
And I thought, man, Bill Jerky, premier irrigator, greatest irrigator in the valley.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, I'm all excited. He's never told me that before.
This award brought to you by Bill Jerky.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So that's fun. And that's part of the farming thing that is so important, is that people really feel that they're a part of part of the food chain and part of producing things that people want and people need. And it's a big deal. It's a big part of what makes a nation stable, to have a plentiful food supply and stable and healthy. And it's just wonderful. We really like being a small part of that. So my corn these days goes over to the ConAgra feedlots over at west of LaSalle. Mm-hmm. They feed 70, 80,000 head of cattle there a day.
Wow.
The corn that I provide them, I figure, may take care of them for a short week.
Right.
Maybe a short week, if that long.
Yeah, well, you're still part of the cycle. And,
yeah.
I mean, you were born here in Weld County, right, Bill?
Yes, I was born in Greeley and have lived out on that family farm that entire time except for school years.
So how many acres do you have?
It's just a short quarter section now.
We've had to
modify our farm through the years as a result of water wars.
Okay.
The particular wars I'm talking about are water well wars, in which farmers have largely lost their legal right to be able to pump their irrigation wells appropriately. And it has to do with taking water out of the aquifer as it's moving to the river, and it's taking that water out of priority. And as a result of taking that water out of priority, you have to replace that water when it would have hit the river. And so you've got to own a tremendous amount of extra water to use your wells. We have deduced that it's far easier for us just to rely on our senior water rights that are ditch rights from the South Platte rather than worrying about water wells.
Interesting.
But as a result of that, we've dried up our corners, and we've sold some corner property off and done some other things. And we've taken hurdles and turned them into opportunities.
Well, Bill, what's funny, something that strikes me is when you have a population that is increasingly urban, whereas this country was, for much of its existence, was largely rural, and people were connected to, you know, the processes by which we have our way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're so disconnected from that something like water and something like ditch rights and talking about, you know, senior rights and well depletion and things like that, I don't think anyone thinks about that when it comes to how their food gets to the table. And this is what farmers are dealing with all the time.
Yeah, it's true, and it was very true in the Colorado legislature this last spring. There was a bill that came up that if 99 out of 100 people wouldn't think this was a good idea, you'd think they're crazy. And it's the rain barrel bill.
Right.
Who could argue against having a rain barrel that would grab the water off of your roof and let you go ahead and water your lawn with it?
Right.
I mean, it just makes all the sense in the world except for one thing, and it's the doctrine of prior appropriation that basically says that I, a downstream irrigator, already have a right to the water that's falling on your property. And it's the old slippery slope of politics.
Yeah.
I can tell you right now that a few rain barrels, even 1,000 rain barrels in the metro area, isn't going to hurt me one bit.
Right.
But I can tell you that the next point down the slippery slope is the fact that urban people will next say, well, if a rain barrel was good, how about parking lots?
Right.
How about all the impervious surfaces? And once you begin to capture the thunderstorms of the greater metro area in the summertime and keep them, retain them, and use them, the river will run dry, and the irrigators who have rights dating back to 1859, they will be the ones that will be deprived, and then the food that we grow on those farms will be greatly diminished from irrigated agriculture on the South Platte because we depend upon metro thunderstorms from the 4th of July on. The snowpack is gone by then.
Yeah, no.
And people don't realize that, and so 99 out of 100 would say, oh, let us have those rain barrels. It's not going to hurt anything.
Yeah, big deal.
It damages the doctrine of prior appropriation, which I might add started right here in River City, Greeley, Colorado, back in the 1870s. And it was one of the very first things that the framers of the Colorado Constitution put into the state constitution was that doctrine of prior appropriation.
Wow. And, I mean, that's one of the things that has allowed Colorado agriculture and, by extension, the Colorado economy to thrive, yes?
Absolutely. It helps us to really move ahead. We have to know what our investments look like. We're not a third world country. This is one of the things that I stress in my fuel presentations.
Right.
Is the reliability of your investment. The simple story on that is that the founders of Greeley, the Union colony in 1870, dug the number 3 ditch, and they found very quickly after a couple of years of use that there wasn't much water in it, and they rode their horses upstream and they found that those rascals in Camp Collins had dug a ditch themselves.
Oh, those dirty Fort Collins people.
Yeah, and so they took that water, and they started their own gardens with it. And, of course, at the point of a gun, they all got together and talked it out, and they decided that prior appropriation made the most sense because the guys that were downstream at Greeley had actually had a prior appropriation by a couple of years to the Fort Collins claim on the water. And so that is the driving force. That is the heart of the Constitution of Colorado water law, right in that one concept, and it started in Greeley. So it's an interesting piece of Colorado water law.
Yeah, 100%. So, Bill, I mean, you are sort of uniquely situated here in terms of the knowledge that you have, because we mentioned that you were county commissioner, and I do want to talk a little bit more about that. But you were also a state legislator.
Yeah, before I was doing the home building and that type of thing in the late 90s, I was a state legislator. I was initially elected in 88 and served through 96. It's amazing to people, say, from your generation, elected in 88. But, Bill, you don't look a day over 42 now. I'm patting myself on the back here.
You don't look a day over 29.
Yeah, 29, exactly.
100%.
Yeah. But, elected in 88, took on an incumbent Democrat, and took him on in a district that normally swung Republican.
Okay.
But in the 86 election year, a long-term Republican had held it for many years. He'd been tarnished with some personal issues. It was an off-presidential year, and so the Democrat won that time, and then I came back in 88, which would have been George Bush Sr.'s year to win. And I came in and won pretty handily then in 88 and continued for four terms.
It's funny. What you're describing reminds me of what happened in the U.S. Congressional District here between Marilyn Musgrave, serving for a long time, name was tarnished a little bit, and then Betsy Markey came in one, was there for one term, and then in comes Cory Gardner.
Yeah, Markey was swept in 2008, with Obama.
Yep.
And that was a tarnished George Bush at the end of his career because Iraq wasn't looking so good at that point. Economy was starting to fail, and Marilyn was swept away with that. And, of course, she was branded as being largely one or two issues, you know, primarily
most elections.
And gay marriage, frankly.
Right.
Those two things were really pinned to her, unfortunately. And, frankly, I can tell you how much broader she was than that.
I go back
so far, John, that when I was in my final term, a young Marilyn Musgrave came to me as an incoming state representative and asked me what committee she should be on. And I said, Marilyn, you have to be on the Ag Committee. You have to, in the Colorado House. And so she said, okay, Representative Jerky, I'll try for the Ag Committee then. Well, she only represented all of northeastern Colorado.
Yeah, only.
So she did that, and she actually did a great job in the Colorado House and in Congress as well, but she was somewhat tarnished at that point.
Right.
Betsy Markey rode the wave. And then, of course, we all know, that Cory Gardner was a force that could not be stopped. And now he's clear all the way to the United States Senate now, and just a tremendous political force.
Yeah. I have a number of friends who have worked with Cory in the state legislature, both sides, when he was in the state house, and he was in the state Senate too, wasn't he? Or was he? I can't remember.
I don't recall if he was. I think he was a state senator.
That seems
right.
But everyone liked him. Everyone liked working with him because Cory, he had just such a collaborative approach and was so friendly and willing to listen to you and sit down. And, he's a great guy.
He can smile more in a day than I can in a week. it's just incredible. And I could have the same voting record as him.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't matter because people would hate me for my voting record. And they still think he's okay with my voting record.
He's tireless in his enthusiasm. It's amazing.
He's absolutely a special talent. But the 8 years I served in the legislature, I served 6 years on state affairs, for example. Okay. I served 6 years on the Appropriations Committee.
Wow.
So I got to see every spending bill coming in. And then I served 8 years on the Agriculture Natural Resource Committee.
Sure.
Two of those years as chair, two of those years as vice chair. 2 years also on state affairs as a chair, too. So I got a chance to be in a leadership role. I saw the handwriting pretty easily, pretty well at that time getting in, and could see that Bev Bledsoe and Chuck Berry and others were all lined up for the senior leadership positions. And I wasn't really necessarily skilled that way, I didn't think.
Right.
But I could probably vie for committee chairmanships and do okay with that. So I went right to Chuck Berry and told him that's what I wanted to try and be as a committee chair. That's all I was looking for. I knew I wouldn't be there forever. Old days, you could be there forever, but not. The term limits came in while I was there.
Right, okay.
So I served my 8 years again. Eight is enough. And
why eight?
Well, 8 years is what the voters passed.
Okay.
I'd served 2 years, and then I could have served another eight. But I served a total of eight total.
Okay.
Instead, so I just figured that eight was the intent of the public and
you
constitutional
honored that.
Vote, and I honored that and thought that was appropriate. So.
And there are no term limits for county commissioners, though, right?
Yeah, there is in Well County.
Oh, there is?
When I got in, it was an 8-year deal.
Okay.
And by the time I'd left or was in the process of leaving, the voters had approved 12 years.
Okay.
And so I could have run for a third term. One of my colleagues did, Dave Long.
Yeah.
He did serve for a third term. And then another colleague tried to, and he was defeated.
Huh.
And so it was kind of a mixed bag on that.
Yeah, wow. So I'm curious, Bill, you grew up on a farm, right?
Yeah.
Agriculture, went to UNC. What'd you get your degree in?
Political science.
Political science. What was it about? Did you always have your eye on public office, or was that something that came to you later?
Well, I never thought that I would run for an office. I didn't think my natural predisposition is one of an inferiority complex.
Okay.
And really, really very, very shy.
What do you attribute that to? Inferiority complex, why?
I don't know. Bad back, short, you name it.
Well, that never occurred to me because I came to know you after you'd served in these two offices.
Uh-huh.
And so you came, the first time I met you, you were presented to me as someone of stature. And
yeah, even though I'm only about 5'7".
Right.
So.
Oh, the height thing, Bill.
Yeah.
But so it's surprising to hear you say that because you've always come off as very confident, very well-spoken. Did that come as a result of service or something you picked up along the way?
I got better along the way. You know, obviously I did get better at it. And well, the first early indication that I was even interested in things were back in the very early 70s in school when I would take the current events tests and I simply watched the news. And so I could, like, blow them away. I knew
and,
all
and
the current
you go,
events.
These are the test questions?
Like, these are like the test questions, just what you saw in the news that night.
Right.
So I was really good at that kind of thing, and that probably showed some interest. And then when I got into college, I figured, oh, I'll be a businessman. So I majored in business, and I found it so incredibly boring.
I did the same
that
thing.
That I couldn't handle it. Could not stand it. Were you a political science
major? No, I
went to communications.
Yeah, I ended up being a speech major because I was a business finance major, and I go, this is what you do, right?
It's where the money is, yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna learn finance. I'm going to learn numbers. And I was just so bored out of my skull. I go, how are people interested in this? And thank God they are because, you know, I believe in the principles of our market system.
Yeah.
But I just getting into the nuts and bolts of it, my eyes started to roll back in my head.
Yeah, I didn't want to do it all the time either. And I found I was a terrible accountant because I wasn't disciplined enough to actually work at it every day, which you need to do. And so I simply flip-flopped the major and minor as I had enough classes in business to make it a nice minor. Mm. And the political science classes, I just hustled a whole bunch of them then the final 2 years. And then I found out when I did my senior check that I was short my science classes.
Oh, no.
Physical science. So I took 3 physical science classes my senior year. I got A's on all of them, and I figured out I should have been a scientist. Instead, I just go around and talk about political philosophy. So I kind of missed a calling there. I should have been in science all along. But so anyway, the political science was always interesting. And so I one time on a whim then got a mailer from the Well County Republican Party to join the 1200 Club. And the 1200 Club at that time was a $12 donation. I was still in college. And so I sent in the $12, and I put an X on the spot that I would actually volunteer. Well, I was like 1 in 10,000 people that actually would say that they would volunteer. So the party was on me immediately to go ahead and try to help. And I found myself then as a candidate driver very soon. And still being in college, I would drive people like Hank Brown for lieutenant governor.
Wow.
Around the state, and I would drive Hank around, and Hank's a young guy then.
Yeah.
You know, this is about 40 years ago now. So Hank is this young, vibrant 35-year-old.
So like 20 years before he became a senator.
Hey, he's scarcely older than you at that point.
Okay, gotcha.
And he's like a 34, 5-year-old guy.
Yeah.
We're driving around the state. He'd been a state senator for a term.
Right.
And a Monford vice president and an attorney. I just found this guy to just be fantastic.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, just the knowledge, the fact he'd served in the legislature a few years, and just the experience at Monfort's, and Anyway, I just thought that this guy walked on water, and he practically did. I mean, let's face it, politically, he still is maybe the best Republican elected in the last half century,
yeah.
More or less.
Probably.
He's really, really good. So he taught me an awful lot
yeah.
during that time period of spending a lot of hours with him. And so he got my interest higher and higher, and I would serve and spend more time with him and others.
Did you work on his staff eventually?
Not at federal level, because I always told myself that I wanted to stay home and,
okay.
and do the things I was doing and not become, frankly, a government employee.
Huh.
I had a big wall against becoming a federal employee and being kind of locked into that lifestyle.
Sure. Bill, a question philosophically, and I'm always curious about people's political origins. What was it about the Republican Party that drew you to it?
Well, I was raised Republican, but obviously freedom, minimum government, minimum taxes, strong defense, a government that would likely approve water projects, for example, to be able to develop and move ahead in this world, as opposed to all of the opposites that I see from the Democrat Party.
Gotcha.
Which is, you know, more pro-environmental, pro-union. You know, to me, never met a sad story that they didn't want to try to find a government solution for.
Right.
And unfortunately, a lot of the problems that people face are problems that they've brought upon themselves that they need to figure out how to work out themselves, because government makes a lousy lousy landlord, lousy dad, lousy banker, lousy all kinds of things. That brings me then to the conclusion that government should be really kept at more of a minimum rather than so heavily influenced in our lives.
So a fairly bedrock conservative principle of the government is a poor deliverer of services compared to solutions provided by the free market and individuals.
Free market, yeah. To a large degree, I really do like the free market. And we've got so many people always bring up things like the Great Depression, you know, and we've got so many different safeguards and safety nets now to hopefully keep that from happening to a large degree. But
to play devil's advocate, were the safety nets and safeguards not the product of the Democrat side?
Yeah, to a large degree, they really were, and many would suggest that the Great Depression was greater, larger, and deeper because they didn't allow some of the things to fail like they should have, and that the recovery would have happened much quicker if, say, some of the bad banks would have sold for 20 cents on the dollar instead of, and you could say the same thing about 2008-09, whether or not those stimuluses were really the way to go or not. I saw bankers literally trembling during that time period, wondering what kind of world we'd be in a matter of days or weeks,
right.
if there were literally runs on banks. And so you do have to wonder and worry always about that full faith and confidence in the United States of America. And if it's eroded deeply enough, wow, what do you have then? Do we have some real life anarchy? Do we
right.
know that $2 at Zoe's will still buy an iced tea or not? Or was it $3? I don't know.
I think it was $2.
Okay, there you go, $2.
It's a heck of a deal here.
But we just don't know, you know, what you face if you don't have that stable system
yeah.
that the U.S. has always been able to provide. And again, you go back to that water law of prior appropriation. That's exactly the kind of thing we're getting at. Irrigators could not make the investment in the West if they didn't know that their investment would be protected by prior appropriation, keeping someone else from diverting water immediately above them and being able to take their water. They would not invest.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why you see so little investment or desire to invest in places like Africa and Latin America and portions of Asia. To me, it's all very related in a big world
sure, yeah.
scheme is to try to provide as much of that security of knowing that you're really going to own what you think you own.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And it's certainly... It certainly informs a political philosophy and a life philosophy. And again, I always like going back to sort of what is the origin? And I ask Democrats the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Democrats, Republicans, like what is at the core of it's easy to get caught up in a lot of sort of almost grandstanding and words, but like there's something in there. There's something that's at the core. What is it?
Yeah.
And it's different for everyone, so that's why I asked.
Yeah, and it's amazing. Some of the best stories you'll hear on that, from my perspective at least, is from minorities who have become Republicans and become elected officials. Susana Martinez, for example, and others like her, governor of New Mexico. People, they tell just riveting stories of finding out that their values were much more closely aligned with the Republican Party in actuality. Then they wind up switching parties, and they are welcomed roundly into the GOP typically.
Interesting. So, okay, a couple of questions about the political process, because I think for most people, it's easy to feel distance from the political process. And to those people, I would say you're probably focusing on levels that are too high. Local government is really where the rubber meets the road. And having done the work that I've done in oil and gas, you have to be involved at the local government level. And the more that you do, the more respect you sort of have for what goes into that process, because it's a lot. First question is, what is it like running for office? What is that campaign process like?
Well, the campaign process is really, really difficult because you have to ask yourself some real soul-searching questions as to whether or not you want to, if you're really prepared.
What are those
it.
Questions?
Yeah, if you're really prepared or not, whether or not it's appropriate, if you want to put your family through it, if there are skeletons, if there are skeletons, how are you going to handle that? Just a lot of things, you know, ranging from the money that you'll be paid, if any, to the time that it's going to take, how you're going to replace the time that you were spending earning better money. And so just a lot of questions to ask that are very daunting. And you see great people all the time think about it and, you know, kind of go through that process and then back off.
Yeah.
George Brockler most recently for U.S. Senate.
Huh.
You can just see people like that, that the wheels are turning. You know, there's a whole bunch of people urging them to do it. And now you see, well, Paul Ryan doing it at the speaker level. Does he want to do that? He's got teenage boys at home, I think. And
even someone
and,
who...
And it's a lose-lose, because I guarantee you that the issues remain the same when John Boehner's gone.
Yeah.
And Paul Ryan will find himself having to make deals with a devil that he would not want to have to make deals with, because he doesn't want to be the speaker who's in charge if America loses its full faith and confidence in the American dollar and the American system.
Interesting.
So you make these deals along the way, these people do at that level, to make sure that we don't lose the whole thing under their watch. Yeah. And if they screw up bad enough, believe it or not, it could start to erode really rapidly. Freedom's not free, and it's very fleeting if we're not careful.
Well, and the doing the business of government it's messy. I mean, I've seen a little bit of how political sausage gets made, and it's not a pleasant process. And it's not for those with a weak stomach. And, I mean, you talking about whether or not you're going to put your family through the campaign process, the time involved. I mean, when you're campaigning, you're always on. And a lot of it happens outside normal business day hours, right? You'll be.
Oh, yeah, you're on a lot of the time, and you got to be on in a way that, well, to come to mind again, Cory Gardner.
Yeah.
Being able to smile and come up with great answers just like that every single time.
And remember every single person you meet. Because and Corey's got a remarkable ability. He remembers me, and he remembers a specific detail about a breakfast we had together. And, you know, he'll latch onto that, and I go, oh, my God, this guy remembers me.
Yeah.
I've met Governor Hickenlooper a few times. He's got that same sort of ability. But putting yourself through that, I think about we're on the eve of the first Democratic presidential debate.
Yeah, tonight.
And whether or not Vice President Biden wants to go through that, and he said himself, he's like, I don't know if my heart's in this.
Isn't it amazing that the biggest potential leaders in the Democratic Party, the party of youth and change, are 370-year-olds? Biden, Hillary, and
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders. 370-year-olds are their biggest and best hope.
That's
so you
got to
find that really amusing, you know?
Yeah, that's I'd never thought of it that way. That's pretty funny.
And then you look at the group of Republicans, some 14, 15 of them or whatever, and so many people are blown away and confused by the fact that there's so many.
Right.
And they'll say things like, oh, I just wish that they'd just get down to one. And I ask them the question, you got a great menu in front of you.
Right.
Would you really prefer to have guys in a back room smoking cigars making that decision for you?
Right.
And so I think we've got a great sample of candidates out there, great menu of candidates to look at.
Well, I mean, the process of running for president is basically it's become a year and a half public flogging, and who can survive the entirety of it is basically.
And why it's
the nominee.
A flogging is really intriguing, because Republicans are held up to a standard of perfection.
Hmm.
They really are. If you're imperfect in almost anything, you're going to get crap kicked out of you. It's going to be ugly. They're really going to be nasty. But you can be Uncle Joe Biden and have your hands all over girls and women, for example, which he does repeatedly at public events. And that's just Uncle Joe being Uncle Joe. It's okay. And they get a pass so much of the time. And I'm just flabbergasted by the fact that Dems get passes. It's talked about all the time on the internet that if a Republican Secretary of State had had his own email server, for example, and done the things that Hillary had done, that he'd probably be indicted by now.
Well, yeah, I would argue, though, that the public process for Hillary has not been kind to her, though. I wouldn't say she's gotten off by any stretch.
She hasn't gotten off, but she hasn't been arrested either.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
they've been treating her pretty rough, and her numbers have gone down. But who do the Democrats turn to? Bernie?
I don't know.
It's just an amazing process to watch.
Well, it's funny. You've seen comparisons, and they both deny it, between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. They're both touching into a very deep populist vein in this country of, I would argue, dissatisfaction with the status quo. Now, they're both doing it in their own way, which I find fascinating. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that holds up over the long term for both of them.
Yeah, I can't imagine either of them actually being the candidate at the end. It would really be surprising to me.
If
both of them were the candidate at the end, it makes somebody like me almost want to do an Alec Baldwin, which is, I think I'll go to Canada.
Well, Canada leans further left than we do.
I know, generally, but...
Okay, going through that process, you obviously survived it a number of times. Can you describe for me sort of what it's like being in the State House? Because we have a term that lasts from January to about May, and we call it a citizen legislature so that they don't pay you guys hardly anything, number one. And number two, it doesn't just end in May, does it?
No, not really. You have a lot of interim committees and such, and so you can be on one or two or three interim committees and meet two or three times a month for a day or two in the summertime and fall. Typically, they'll not run them into the fall of an election year, so your odd years when you'll have the most of that time period of interim committees. But the pay when I served was $17.5 a year, and at the distance that I served from out of Denver legislators, or paid a per diem, a daily allowance, for the 120 days of another $99 a day.
Oh, okay.
So that was an extra $12,000 a year, basically. Huh. So I got basically about $29.5 for what was viewed as a part-time job. It was part-time to a degree, but you still, you know, had to behave appropriately, and you still had to study constantly.
Sure.
Now, when I served, it was, frankly, the days before the internet. I got out in 96, and there wasn't much going with the internet by that time.
No, not really.
We barely had cell phones, and it wasn't anywhere near as hyped up as it is today in a lot of ways.
I gotcha. So, I mean, how are you expected to... That's not a lot of money, first of all. And secondly, how are you expected to run your business or do business or have a job outside of the legislature when it takes up already half the year, and then you're talking about committees, and then you're talking about being in your district and campaigning?
I think that politics should be a representative situation in a citizen legislature, but it should also be a narrowing and winnowing process so that people who have enough success and have enough ability to put their acts together, their lives together, have the opportunity to serve. If you're somebody who can't get their life together that well, then maybe somebody else from your district ought to serve. So that's a part of the answer. And it's kind of a funny thing because you mentioned salary a couple of times. 17.5, I was on Appropriations Committee for 6 years. For 6 years, I personally had a heavy hand in making sure that legislative salaries stayed at 17.5.
How did your colleagues feel about that?
The first year after I left, they raised the salary to 30. Yeah, I think they were pretty glad that I left.
Yeah.
But that was just as an example. I was pretty tight. I would win the Colorado Union of Taxpayers Award. I won it outright or tied for winning it 3 out of my 8 years. So I tried to be tight with the taxpayers' dollar and treat it as I thought that it should be treated, with a good deal of respect. Tabor was very new when I was there.
Okay.
And so Tabor was treated as part of the Constitution that needed to be respected. It's the will of the people. Those political times called for people to not engage in new programs, not start new stuff that was going to run extra money, and to try to go ahead and figure out how to help people be more self-reliant and more independent rather than dependent. So that was heavy in that era.
Those policies and you, your general philosophy in approaching that, it makes you a good fit for Weld County, because Weld County is, if I'm not mistaken, one of the only counties in the entire country that doesn't carry any debt.
It's one of the few, and it's perhaps the only one that carries no debt and also has no sales tax, when you throw that in with it.
Jeez.
Because sales tax, there's plenty of counties that have no debt, but they typically always have a sales tax that
right.
supplements the property tax, and we don't have one.
Weld County, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't even bond for road projects. They end up just paying for them in cash, right?
We pay cash, yeah. We don't build it until we can write a check.
And how do you, I mean, how is the government run that way? Because it seems like even businesses carry debt, but Weld County, no debt and no bonding. How do you set up a government to run like that?
Well, in the late 70s, 1970s, Weld County was a new home rule county. It had been a constitutional county before that with respect to its government. And they had three commissioners back in the early 70s who were, one was all powerful, and he was able to always have a yes vote from his lapdog. And then okay. the third commissioner was just left out.
Right.
And so the voters got together and they said, we're going to have a charter, and they passed a charter so that that powerful commissioner would no longer rule like that, that they would have five commissioners. They okay. put specific spending limitations in it that were tighter than Tabor.
Wow.
And so funny thing happened then before that in 74, which we put in quite a few Democrats following Watergate.
Oh.
So I believe there was a majority Democrat county commission then in 77, and they hired a young man out of California named Don Warden, and they put a tax question on the ballot asking for more taxes from the voters, and the voters turned him down horribly, mercilessly,
huh.
and beat him down, and they said to Don, you figure out, Don, you're our finance director, you figure out how to get things done and without ever raising taxes, because we don't want to ever have that whooping again.
Right.
And Don figured out, this is just Dave Ramsey kind of stuff. It's the stuff that grandma taught and learned.
Right.
This is basic stuff. If you want to build something or do something, save for it. Put it away for a few years. And then when you're ready, build it.
Then pay
or buy
for
it. And pay for it in cash.
Huh.
Everything that we've got in Weld County, to my knowledge, is set up on depreciation schedules in which the county actually puts away the money. It's like if a business is depreciating a building, 20 years, $200,000 building,
right.
depreciating at $10,000 a year. What you really ought to do is put away that $10,000
yeah.
into a separate account. Nobody does that. Weld County does. Along the way, when I was a commish, we started an aggregate hauling branch of the Public Works Department because, we needed to. Let's put it that way.
Right.
So we started one up, and we bought 20 trucks with cash. And from the day we bought them, we had itemized in there for the employees' uniforms.
Huh.
Because they'd get a standard outfit that they would wear. We had everything budgeted in there and money put away every month to go ahead and replace those trucks at the anticipated time when those trucks would depreciate out. That's the way you do things. If you want to build County Road 49 and spend over $100 million doing it, you put away that kind of money.
Wow.
And that's what they've been able to do, partially because of old industry, oil and gas.
Right.
But a lot of it has to do with the spending limitations that they've had through the years, which force them to go ahead and save serious money before they build or buy anything.
Is it ever difficult? Because I imagine there are times where the public says, we need this, or there will be demands made by the voting public. Is there ever, granted you have spending limits, but is there ever temptation to go, okay, we really need to fulfill this. Let's just go ahead and do that? Or how difficult is it to stay disciplined?
They're pretty disciplined. I will tell you that there was one other try for a tax increase back in the year 2000. Then Commissioner Kirkmeyer, who is a commissioner again, was hounded by her electorate in Southwest Weld to have an open space tax. Yeah, they were butting up against Boulder
right.
County. It was big in Boulder County, and they wanted to go ahead and preserve a lot of open space land in Southwest Weld. And they asked for the voters of Weld County to pay for it in, I believe, a sales tax at the time. I was a candidate for commissioner in 2000. The commissioners came out pushing it to give those voters in Southwest Weld a chance, you know, a voice to
sure.
at least run it up the flagpole, see if anybody salutes. I came out solidly against it, and two-thirds of the voters agreed with me. So that was soundly defeated. I don't think that there's been a question since then.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I think the voters of Weld County, as county government voters, now they may vote differently for a school district, for a fire district, and so there's lots of those other governments that do have bonding.
Okay, yeah.
School districts are a little different. They kind of have to spend it all. It's pretty hard for them to save up a substantial enough amount of money to literally build new schools. That's pretty hard to do.
Yeah.
And so that is anticipated in state law. They're allowed to go ahead and bond and then have an additional property tax mill levy increase to be able to pull that off for X number of years.
Yeah. Okay, I understand.
But for the county government itself, nope. You save, you build up a corpus of money, then you buy it or you build it.
Well, Bill, for the last few years, you've transitioned out of elected office and, you know, have been working in a number of different capacities. Is there anything about being in public office that you miss?
Oh, sometimes the camaraderie of getting together as kind of a team, that's a little bit tough, and I do miss that on occasion. Moving forth to make something happen can be a good thing, and being a part of that is enjoyable.
Yeah.
You don't enjoy when you get your butt kicked on something in which maybe there was a hole somewhere in the defense.
Right.
And the other side scores and scores badly. I'll tell you this one real briefly.
Yeah.
That number of years ago when I was a commissioner, about 10 years ago now, there was a hole in our defense at the county jail.
Okay.
And what happened was the prisoners, due to court cases, were able to research the law library to be able to find out how their defense could be done. And so some of the prisoners at the Weld County Jail, they got into the law library that was provided for them. And I thought it was, I'm not a computer guy, but I thought it was a closed box system in which they weren't getting into the internet.
Right.
Guess what? They got into the internet. They accessed the county employment files. They knew all of the names of every county employee, their checking account numbers, and their social security numbers.
Wow.
In the bank that we were all at.
Yeah.
And that, you talk about it hitting the fan. That was a big deal. Sheriff's Department, the county commissioners, all of us, we pulled together in moments, and we brought in the computer contractor to create the firewall and get those guys out of there so that it couldn't get any worse. We also brought in the county bank contractor, contract bank, that we had and still have, to my knowledge, is Wells Fargo. We brought in their top guy, from Greeley. And absolutely, they set up a special Saturday, the very next Saturday. They held the bank open for all county employees at no cost to us, no cost to the county, no cost to the county taxpayer or the employees. They set up brand new checking and savings accounts for everybody.
Wow.
So we all got secure accounts immediately. Not a penny was lost. Not a dime was lost anywhere. No taxpayer money was lost. And we learned a lot about that. Now, the reason we had to give them that, it was a constitutional question that that the accused has a right to be able to aid in their defense.
Yeah.
And so that's what these guys did, but they got right into the internet and they hacked right in.
Wow.
So these guys were pretty smart.
Yeah.
They hacked right in and there was not adequate firewalls with our computer contractor at the time. They're still our contractor. We caught a lot of grief from, if you remember the name Paula Woodward, Channel 9 News. She came and interviewed us, and interviewed me in particular. And I can tell you, the time of day that she came was about 11:30 or 12, and she interviewed me alone with just Don Warden.
Uh-huh.
I can tell you that Paula did not need to eat lunch because she had me for lunch.
Wow.
Now, Paula, in her ultimate wisdom, decided not to air what would have been a very damaging interview.
Huh.
It's not like this interview that we've had.
No, no.
This was really nasty, and those cameras were hot.
Yeah.
And I did not fare well, and they never did air it, and I really appreciate the fact that they didn't.
Do you know why not?
I don't know why. Apparently they looked at it, and I know that Don stepped into it at a certain point, and said, look, we've done everything we can.
Yeah.
We've never had a problem with this contractor before. And I think they kind of quieted down. Huh. I, even in spite of having a lot of years of elective office at that time, I just did not handle that one well.
Yeah.
Could have taken classes from George Merlis or whatever his name is.
Right, yeah.
And so on. Because I was not good on that one.
Wow.
Have to admit. But survived it, you know, went on. But that was a big one. And it, again, it made the news. And frankly, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, could have been compromised by criminals wow. accessing our accounts.
Not a fun day.
No, not a great day.
Yikes. So, but now, in the last few years, since your term ended in 2010, right?
2008.
2008, excuse me. So since then, I mean, you've done a number of things. You ran the Christmas tree farm for 4 years, winded that down. Chairman of Fuel.
Yeah.
Fostering unity, energizing leadership. Working with Energy Proud. Give me a rundown of some of the things that you're doing right now, Bill, and give me the elevator speech for Fuel.
Well, Fuel is fantastic. Fostering unity, energizing leadership came about as a result of my sitting down with good people from Noble Energy at the time and talking about the common problem that we have in the extractive industries and the natural resource industries of making enemies wherever we go, it seems, with people being NIMBYs and not wanting oil and gas, not liking agriculture, oh, in the middle of the night, or the crop dusters,
right.
or the smells, or whatever it might be. The miners felt the same way. These are people that have aggregate mines, oil and gas, but the aggregate mines in particular, they face a lot of problems as well. And then the final one we've kind of thrown in, because they face tremendous environmental opposition, is water development.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be best typified by company or entities like the Northern Colorado Conservancy District, NISP, the Northern Integrated Supply Project, for example,
right.
which really, when we look at it, would save 40,000-50,000 acres of irrigated land if it's developed appropriately and give Fort Collins another horse tooth to recreate on,
right.
which we think is pretty neat stuff. But so we got that together. We put the people together, and we've had a number of companies and entities that have been involved with it the last few years. Obviously, Noble, Liberty Oil, too, JBS Swift, the feedlot division, AgPro with Tom Aaron, for example, some of the mining companies, and DCP Midstream, and Vara Companies, and Martin Marietta, and so on. So quite a few different companies have contributed financially to it. And we designed a really nice 30-minute presentation, PowerPoint presentation with beautiful slides, created a 501c4 that brings in some money into it and then expends that money back out, and it's considered a nonprofit that does allow us to get involved politically, but just at the periphery of the issues kind of campaigns, not in the R versus D type of campaigns. And so we've used it to educate the public better throughout the region about the natural resources, the history, what we do in the present, what we hope to do in the future with these various natural resources. We give them factual information about how each of them interact together and work together. We would have seen one of the best examples of it probably in this calendar year. We saw one of the best examples with a number of the Fuel members coming forth to help Martin Marietta with their land use case out in Western Well County. We obtained letters from, I think, most, if not all, of the Fuel members in support of Martin Marietta's controversial plant that they're building out on the county line with Larimer County. It faced tremendous opposition, mostly NIMBY opposition. The opposition was not well-founded scientifically, mm-hmm. but were quite emotional. And when push came to shove, with the political cover that we helped provide, the commissioners approved it on a 5-0 vote.
Wow.
And so that will provide very much needed asphalt and cement products and aggregate products for the entire region, you know, from Fort Collins down to Longmont and east all the way through Well County, and it'll provide the product that we need to have to continue building things like a third lane for I-25 and build those build some of the new structure out on the County Road 49 that Bidweld is advancing so much.
Yeah.
So that's something that Fuel did, and it was always envisioned to try to help in that way as well as to help educate the public in general. So I've given, I don't know if I've given 100 speeches over these years, but I would guess somewhere in that general area, plus an awful lot of contact, if you will, this would be an example of one of those kinds of contexts, this interview.
Sure. Because
obviously we've related to fuel some of the time, too. So that's what fuel does, and we go out and we talk, and we get active under the scenes politically a little bit now, as well as wear the white hat with the presentations.
Bill, I'll tell you, we're about at an hour, so we need to wind this down. But one of the reasons that it's funny, you know, when you talk about fuel between aggregate mining, oil and gas, agriculture, water, I mean, it's almost like your entire career has led up to this point, and it makes you sort of ideally suited to almost be the ambassador for Weld County. You're describing why Weld County has had the success that it has, and given that you were a commissioner, state representative, you've been in agriculture, you have oil and gas on your property, all those things come together, and you look at fuel, you go, well, who else could do it? You know?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and it is something my wife has mentioned, too, that, you know, this is kind of crescendo or whatever, if you will, of career. You know, it's what I've done for 40 years, coming off a farm and studying political science.
Yeah.
Those aren't two things that typically go together. But in this case,
not
they
obviously.
Do. Yeah.
But I think once you get deep down, almost everything, when you get right down to it, is government relations.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of government relations that go on with this. And,
yeah.
And relations, period, in life in general, I think that we're all about relations
with
each other.
Yeah, making connections in ways that we may not have understood before.
And it's not necessarily this old saying of, it's not what you know, it's who you know. You need to know a whole lot, too.
Yeah.
And then it helps to know a whole bunch of good people as well, from lots of walks in life, to be able to get good things done that you want to get done.
Yeah.
You know, people that you can call upon for experience and wisdom in all kinds of different walks.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Bill, I'm glad that we've gotten the chance to work together as much as we have. And it was cool getting to highlight your story in this forum, because when I started this, I started a list, and I remember thinking, I'm like, okay, who are the people I know who would make for good guests? And you were on that list. Took me a year and a half to get to you, but here we are.
It's okay. Better late than never.
So I'll tell you what. Give us the plug for fuel. Where can people find you? How can they get in touch with you if they want to learn more about fuel, if they want to learn more about you? What are the best ways to do that?
Probably the best ways are to take a look at Fuel's Facebook page. I keep that more active than I do website. Okay. I find that I'm website challenged, but the Facebook page is the best these days. So you look at Fostering Unity, Energizing Leadership, and I would think it would show up pretty easily. And simply friend that, and you can get updates on that. I post an awful lot of articles on that I think are relevant to the various things we've talked about. You can also look at the website, but it isn't as current. Just be honest, it isn't as current always as Facebook is.
Cool, Bill. And that's fuelcolorado.com?
Yeah, fuelcolorado.com for website, and then just Fostering Unity, Energizing Leadership for the Facebook page.
Well, fantastic, Bill. I'll tell you what, this was a real treat for me, and continued success to you, my man.
Thank you. Appreciate it, John.
And we close the book on episode 78 here on the John of All Trades podcast. Thank you, Bill Jerky, for being on the show. And thanks for being a great dude and being a good steward of the government, a good steward of the land. And I would call you Weld County's ambassador, as I did at the back end of this episode. I say it again now. So, Bill Jerky, you can find him. He's executive director of Fuel. Check them out, fuelcolorado.com. Also, look them up on Facebook. We'll link to that in the blog post. You can find that at johnofalltrades.us. We have every episode housed there, and every episode is also on iTunes. So just search John of All Trades, J-O-N of All Trades, in iTunes. We're also on Stitcher if you prefer live radio streaming. That's a great service to do it with. Facebook and Twitter, you know where to find us. It's J-O-A-T Pod. John of All Trades is a production of Deft Communications. Check us out on the web, DEFTCOM.us. We will see you next Monday, where we announce next week's episode. We tease it out a little bit, and then we'll be back here on Wednesday. So until then, say goodnight, Gracie.